This is BBC Five Live.
It's 8 o'clock on Five Live. This is Ian Lee. In the next 30 minutes, find out how you could control your TV and lights at home with just the wiggle of a Bluetooth ring. Richard Foster's got the news. Well, it's 5 minutes past eight. Hello, Alice, if you've just tuned in, going, well, hang on a second, where's Chris? Where's Chris Warburton? What's going on? Chris isn't in this evening. This is Ian Lee. I'm filling in for him for just 1 week. Don't panic. We're not radically changing anything. We've got all the usual suspects coming up. We'll be talking about gadgets and websites and cars and all of those things. Well, also, one of the things I want to ask you today, we'll be talking about, can I say this without revealing too much? Yes, I think I can. Fish driving their own fish tanks, not big war tanks, that would be ridiculous. Whereas fish driving glass tanks, that's not ridiculous in the slightest, is it? Now, I'm a pet owner, I've owned fish. They're the hardest thing to keep alive, aren't they? They just keep dying, as did my rabbit. But I want to know the weirdest, oddest toy, gadget, thing, whatever it is you've bought for your pets, please. You can text me, 85058. We buy this stuff for our cat, catnip. Now, cat owners will know what I'm talking about. You get some catnip and you spray it. It is like giving the cat drugs. It goes nuts. Have you seen it? It goes nuts. The weirdest, oddest, strangest thing you've bought for your pet, please. The most expensive. You can send me a text, 85058. We'll be talking about that a little bit later on. A very packed show. So let's crack on, shall we? The Labour MP for Rochdale, Simon Danchuk, who recently published a book which detailed his investigation into allegations of child abuse surrounding the former Liberal MP, Cyril Smith. Well, now he's been contacted by police regarding allegations of abuse by another politician. Our political correspondent, Alex Forsyth, can tell us more. Alex, remind us of the background to this, please.
Yeah, Ian, well, Mr. Danchuk is the Labour MP for Rochdale, and as you say, he recently published this book called Smile for the Camera, The Double Life of Cyril Smith, and that detailed his investigation into these allegations of child abuse, which for some time have surrounded his Liberal predecessor, the MP Cyril Smith, who was Rochdale's MP for 20 years. Now today, Mr. Danchuk has been speaking to Radio 4's PM programme about the fallout from that book he published, and he said he expected it and the allegations within it to have an impact. He expected there to be some fallout from the Liberal Party, but what he didn't anticipate was that he'd be speaking to police officers from different forces across the country about allegations against other parliamentarians across political parties. Now, Simon Danchuk said today that detectives visited his constituency office on Friday to discuss a case involving a senior Labour figure and the alleged aggressive and predatory abuse of boys. Now, that figure can't be identified for legal reasons, and of course, it's very important to say these are only allegations being discussed.
What was Mr. Danchuk's response to the visit?
Well, he got quite emotional in this interview that he gave. He said he didn't go into politics to examine the issue of child abuse. This has been pushed upon him, and he said it's harrowing listening to some of these stories, but of course, he made the point, but never as harrowing as what the victims themselves have been through. But he did say, in his view, there's a need for a joined-up investigation into these various allegations. There's a number of disparate police investigations going on up and down the United Kingdom into allegations of child abuse. He thinks they need to be brought together and well-resourced rather than have these separate investigations by individual police forces. And he's formed a four-strong cross-party group of MPs, and they're going to write to the Home Secretary to urge her to make sure that in these ongoing investigations, all documents relating to these allegations are made available to the police and to those who need them.
Alex Forsyth, thank you very much for that. This is Ian Lee. This is Saturday edition. Now, the UN Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, has welcomed the release of international observers from the OSCE and their local staff who were being held in eastern Ukraine. The seven international military observers from the Organization for Security and Cooperation are now in Kiev after being released by pro-Russian separatists. Russia had been under Western pressure to secure the team's release, in part to reduce tensions in eastern Ukraine. Meanwhile, pro-Russia supporters in the city of Odessa have been protesting after 42 people were killed yesterday. Friday's clashes culminated in a major fire at a trade union building where most of the deaths occurred. Well, earlier on today, I spoke to our correspondent David Stern, who's in Odessa, and I asked him if there were any more signs of trouble in the city.
It has calmed down, but one could say that it might be more of a feeling of shock here. The quietness could be temporary. We were over at the trade union's house earlier, and there was a great deal of anger. Now, it should be said it was a small crowd, around 200 or 300 people, but they were extremely animated, extremely emotional, and extremely angry. Angry at the protesters who threw Molotov cocktails, petrol bombs at the trade union's house that started the fire. These were pro-Ukrainian protesters who and were throwing these at the pro-Russian protesters. There was anger at the Ukrainian government. There was anger at the West, especially because they see the West was supporting. They see the West as supporting the government, and there was also anger at the police. There was a lot of shouting because, to be honest, it seemed when you view the video that the police were very passive during this entire thing.
This has been a big and rather sudden increase in violent activity. Do you think we can expect more of this?
Well, it may not happen in Odessa. This was very unexpected. Odessa up until now has been relatively untouched by the unrest. They have had demonstrations. They have had clashes, but nothing along those lines. Also, obviously, this is the largest number of fatalities that we've had since the demonstrations in February when more than 100 people were killed in Kiev. So this may not be, we might not see the unrest here in Odessa, but there seems to be a reaction that is obviously a great deal of outrage, and we might see something else in other cities in Ukraine.
Now let's go on to the hostages, the military observers that were taken captive and have since been relieved. Is it surprising that they were released today when fighting is intensifying in other parts of the country?
Well, it's difficult to say exactly if it was surprising because we don't know all the details around that. It was said that they were released without conditions. I guess we could say that it's a good sign and perhaps also a huge relief because obviously as the fighting goes on, their lives were in even greater danger. But what exactly the negotiations were, we don't even really know why the pro-Russian activists seized them in the first place.
There was a lot of pressure on Russia to secure the release. Has this helped reduce tensions, do you think?
Well, it remains to be seen. Obviously, tensions are extremely high, so even if they're reduced a little bit, they're still at an unbelievable level. But Russia has also said that they don't have any control over the separatists in the East anymore. They say the separatists are basically will do whatever they want to do. So whether this is reduced as improved tensions or improved relations between Kiev and Moscow, Moscow is saying, well, they're the activists, the militants in the East, and they're their own group now. So whatever Moscow has influence they have or they don't have, it seems that the fighting goes on, and the problems, the unbelievable explosive tensions in the East also continue.
David, just on a personal level, I'm always amazed by reporters and people who are working in dangerous parts of the world. Are you not afraid at all? Are you not nervous for your own safety?
Well, I guess you could say I always have an out. I can leave. I'm not unlike like the majority of Ukrainians, they who are living in this country and living with this day by day. The danger has been, I guess you could say, relatively isolated, or not isolated, in restricted areas. So one always knows where what one needs to do and what if one goes to these places. But yes, I guess you could say that there is. It's at the back of my mind. I feel very much like a Ukrainian in some respects. I've been here for the last 5 years, and there is the constant knowledge or the constant concern that this could explode into something much bigger, especially after having seen what happened last night in Odessa. This is a extremely sensitive and explosive situation in the country, and especially where I am right now.
Well, that's David Stern in Odessa. I do not envy his job at the moment at all. I mean, he's reporting on history, but gosh. Well, that was me speaking to David Stern, who's in Odessa a little bit later on. Hello, this is Ian Lee. This is BBC Five Live, and right now it's exactly 14 minutes past 8.
On digital radio, digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Saturday edition.
Saturday edition. It's a 8:15. If you want to get in touch with the show and take part, you can send me a text, 85058. Right now, it's time to talk technology, as we do every week, with our tech expert, Maddie Mo. Hello, Maddie.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, I'm all right, thank you very much. Now, you've got some... Well, yes, I can say it without being rude. You've got some weird stuff.
I like to find the kooky stories.
You've got some very odd stuff. But first up this week, good news if you're a fan of this.
The road to power is paved with hypocrisy and casualties. I need to prove what the Vice President is capable of.
I know you'll do whatever you think is best. I need to know that I wasn't a part of someone's...
Finish your thought.
Part of someone's murder.
What are you up to?
I'm really scared this time. I know how to handle him.
Watch yourself. I want him obliterated.
Let's make him suffer.
He's gonna get away with it, isn't he?
For those of us climbing to the top of the food chain, there can be no mercy. And the butchery begins.
Gosh, I feel like I've seen the whole series now.
That was very dramatic.
Wasn't it? I'm a little bit shook up. That's the Netflix-produced political thriller House of Cards, now back for its second series. Netflix, of course, also produces the excellent Arrested Development and Breaking Bad. Oh, now they're programmes. If you've got a Netflix account but no way of watching it on your TV, well, there's good news. A new piece of kit from Google called
The Chromecast.
The Chromecast, thank you. You can stream content over your wireless network from your tablet on your smartphone. How does it work?
Right, so the Chromecast, it's a small device that connects your TV to your smartphone or tablet. It's about the same size as a Wi-Fi dongle, and you just plug it into one of your television's HDMI ports. But essentially, it turns any bog-standard television into a smart TV, and it allows you to watch a handful of online streaming services like Netflix, and it's only £30.
Hang on a second, that's pretty cheap, because a lot of these things that turn your TV into an internet TV cost a lot more. It works with Netflix. Does it work with other things like YouTube? So
other apps include, you've got BBC iPlayer, YouTube, an app called Plex, which allows you to stream any media stored locally on your device. You've got a couple of gaming apps, something that's called CastPad, which turns your television into a drawing pad.
What?
But also...
What's wrong with a bit of paper and a pen? We don't want to draw on our TVs.
The future, Ian.
Oh, man.
But it also has the technology to mirror your device's screen, so anything you can watch on your device can just be beamed onto the television screen.
Now, £30, it sounds a bargain, but there are other ways of doing this. For example, I do this on my Xbox. The Xbox, you can control the TV through that. It's wonderful. What other things are there out there that people can use?
Also, price-wise, the Chromecast, it is brilliant. It's only £30. And if all you want is the ability to watch Netflix, a bit of catch-up TV, without wanting to upgrade your television, then this is perfect. But there is something called the Roku Stick, which is about £50, but it does have a much larger selection of streaming apps, including 4OD and Demand 5. But another option, if you have Sky, is the Sky Now TV box, which is about £10 with your Sky TV package. But this gives you access to Sky pay-as-you-go movies, all their on-demand services, and also a whole host of streaming apps. So the Chromecast is pretty much bang in the middle in terms of price.
Let's be honest, most people just use these things to watch silly videos on YouTube.
I don't know.
Do you not?
No, I think this is the future. I mean, personally, I rarely watch scheduled television anymore. Yeah. And I think that more and more we like to have the option and also the flexibility as to when we want to watch content. And I also think people are reluctant to pay for these quite expensive TV packages, which have hundreds of channels that you just simply don't watch, when you could go for a cheaper service, which gives you much more flexibility.
Can I say, just talking about YouTube, can I say three words Words to you that will change your life? And don't worry, this is suitable for children and everybody. Sexy Sax Man. Have you seen the Sexy Sax Man? Honestly,
I've seen a lot of YouTube videos, but that is not something I've seen.
He's this fella that runs around with a mullet, bursting into places, playing Careless Whisper on the saxophone.
That sounds brilliant.
Honestly, it's the funniest. It's safe for kids. It's safe for. It is so funny. I just found that the other week, and it was
Sexy Sax Man.
Sexy Sax Man. Now, listen, wearable technology. Apparently, it's the next big thing. I've got a calculator watch, and that's kind of as far as I've gone. Samsung are pushing their smartwatch, the Samsung Gear. Google have got Google Glass. Mm-hmm. And on Saturday edition a month or so ago, we heard about the first wearable tech fashion show, which included smart Lycra cycling shorts. It just doesn't really...
Indeed.
And HD sunglasses. But there's been one notable absence in the wearable tech world. Apple haven't really been involved, but that could be about to change. Yeah. Maddie, there are rumours, aren't there, about these special headphones?
Yes, yeah, so Apple have been keeping pretty quiet, but according to some rumours that are on this anonymous sharing app called Secret, it's possible that a future version of Apple's EarPods, which is the name for their headphones, may include sensors to measure your heart rate, temperature and blood pressure, so all your fitness monitoring goodies. But as with all the rumours, that you do have to take them with a bit of a pinch of salt. But these ones have been backed by patents filed by Apple. So it's possible that this could be the way they're going to venture into the fitness tracking.
Why? Why do I want headphones that monitor my heart rate and tell me how unfit I am? Because that's what they'd be saying.
Well, I mean, the idea in the patent place is for this biometric headphone system. So the actual EarPods will possibly, who knows, have integrated sensors that can measure your heart rate, perspiration levels and so on and so forth. But I think at the moment, it's the Samsung Galaxy S5 is the only smartphone which has a heart rate monitor. But at the moment, to use that, you would have to stop exercising, place your finger on the back of the phone. So it's kind of counterproductive. It's not actually that useful. But it makes complete sense to have this technology in your earphones that you're likely to be wearing whilst you're working out anyway. So Apple have just found the intuitive, straightforward solution.
Apple, I'm surprised that they've dragged their heels. I mean, Google have been talking about their glasses for a couple of years now. We've heard all these different, Nike have kind of had a go at it. Why are Apple so slow to get in on the wearable tech market?
I just think they've been waiting to put out a market leading product. And when they do that, they're going to want to put something out there which is rid of all of the little niggles and problems that some of the early smartwatches and fitness bands have had. And, you know, these earphones are a good example. We've seen, you know, other companies who are putting products out there, but they're not quite right. Apple are just holding back till they have the most practical, intuitive solution. So it's just a matter of time and waiting. But I'm sure that when the product finally does come to market, it's going to be extremely good.
You mentioned the phone. Well, I don't understand the connection between phones and fitness. Why phone companies are so obsessed with telling us how healthy we are or are not?
I just think it's the next thing to be integrated into just one singular device. We've had fitness bands and smartphones, and now we have phones and watches that do everything. Plus, to be honest, we could probably do with the advice.
All mine would say is you are getting old and you are sweaty and unfit. I can't even walk up a set of stairs now without breaking out into a sweat.
I think you need a fitness band.
Now, the source of the rumours, this is what's interesting me about this. This website called Secret, which allows people to post anonymously. And it's, how reliable is this? Because there's a lot of good gossip coming from this website, isn't there?
It is gossip. Secret was built so that people could, I quote actually, be themselves and share anything they're thinking and feeling with their friends without judgment. Yes. But so far it's proved a huge hit amongst Silicon Valley technology firms. I think that's because this is just an area which is a hotbed of rumours. Mm. You've got patents being filed here, there, all over the place, a huge amount of secrecy and also a lot of smiling through gritted teeth. And this app is just almost part therapy, a little bit of confession here and there, and also it's just quite fun to eavesdrop. So that's where this app has sort of found its place.
Do we believe these websites? Because every now and then you'll get a rumour about the new PlayStation or the new Xbox, and there'll be a photo of it and it'll be online, and it'll be someone left a model of it in a bar. Yeah. And most of the time it's a load of old guff, isn't it, that people have made
up. Exactly. You do have to take all of the rumours with a pinch of salt. But with these headphones, the fact that they are backed by patents that are being filed by Apple suggests that it's probably not going to be exactly what we're seeing here in the rumour, but it's probably along the right lines.
It gives it a little bit of credibility. Okay, exactly. So sticking with wearable tech, this is an interesting one. A former Google engineer has developed a Bluetooth ring which allows you to control everything from your TV, your phone, even the lights in your home just by wiggling your finger. I'll let him explain.
Nod enables you to interact with anything around you. It's got a capacitive touch all over, and we have a touch slider. So when you slide, for example, you can slide your presentation, or in the context of music, you're going to the next track, previous track. You can play, pause, and you can change your volume or change your channel on TVs. And then comes motion. So you can do a two-finger gesture like this to scroll on your TV.
Well, that's ex-Google engineer Anoush Elangovan explaining his Bluetooth ring. One can only imagine what gestures he was making there. It's in competition with a similar device that came out a couple of months ago, but this one apparently has an added function. Is that right?
Yeah, so you wear the ring on your forefinger, and this has a touch slider, which the engineer that he just mentioned, which allows you to do things very simply. So your thumb is perfectly placed to just slide and swipe over that flat surface. But it means you can do things like flick through pages of an e-book, slides of a presentation, channels on a television or volume. So that's the main difference. Plus, this ring has a lot of financial backing, which we haven't seen before in other similar devices.
It's 90 quid. Is it going to take off?
Do you know, I actually think the ring is not that bad price, but it's not necessarily the Bluetooth ring that's expensive. But to reap the full benefits of something like the Nod, it helps to have a fully smart connected home. So we're talking smart televisions, Nest wireless heating systems, smart lights. And I think that when these sorts of items become more commonplace, that's when something like Nod will come into its own.
Smart lights. I've never heard of smart lights. How do you connect this thing to your smart lights?
Well, so an example of a smart light would be the Philips Hue lights.
Yeah.
And they can be wirelessly connected, so you can program and turn them on, off and dim them from your tablet or a device. So this could also be compatible with the ring. It's just a case of programming the Nod as one of your controllable devices. But these light bulbs are really expensive. At the moment, a single one will cost you about £50.
What?
I know.
For a light bulb?
So you're talking a couple of grand to sort out a whole house. But if you did have one, you'd be able to turn all the lights off in your house simply by clenching your fist.
Yeah, that'll solve the obesity problem. You can't even get up and turn. Hey, listen, let's throw this out there. What would you like from your technology? We've got a ring that can control the lights. We've got all these kind of bits and pieces. What would you like from technology? 85058. Send us a text and let us know. Now, this is what I would like from my technology. At last, somebody has done what we've all been waiting for. It's a design from the Netherlands. It's a prototype smart fish tank. This is awesome. I've been watching the video of it all afternoon. It's wonderful. Describe it to the listener, please, Maddie.
Okay, so this is Studio Dip's Fish on Wheels. It looks a little bit like a miniature fish tank with a singular goldfish inside it. And that tank is mounted on the bottom half of a remote-controlled car. And then there's a little webcam, which looks...
It's brilliant!
So the webcam looks down onto the tank, which then monitors the direction the fish is swimming in, and then it converts that information into instructions to steer the device. So if your fish is swimming towards the right of the fish tank, that's where your remote control car is going to go.
The fish is driving the car. For goodness sake, scientists, why has it taken so long to invent this?
Finally!
Why? What is the point of this, apart from making me laugh?
To liberate fish all over the world.
Yeah.
No, I mean, to be completely honest, the studio... their main interest is designing intelligent imaging products, and I think this is just a really fantastic way of getting publicity for their company. And this device is just showcasing their skills. They've created something using just a standard webcam, a microcomputer and a simple battery-powered motor. And this kooky gadget is just getting really good coverage for their company, and it is quite fun. It's a little bit like putting a hamster in a ball and letting it run around, but it's more funny and more pointless.
Oh, those hamsters in those balls, aren't they wonderful? but there will be some people listening going, well, hang on a second, this must be dangerous for the fish, Maddie.
Well, just to put your mind at rest, I will let the inventor explain some of the safety concerns of driving this fish tank. So this is Thomas DeWolf.
Yeah, we've looked into that, and it is indeed stressful for the fish if you move too fast or you accelerate too fast. That's the main issue. But if you move it slower and more gently, then the water doesn't even move that much, so the fish won't feel much of the movement of the car.
Well, it sounds absolutely awesome, Maddie, and it's worth getting fish just to have fish driving around.
It's a bit of fun, isn't it? Definitely a bit of fun, but have a look at the tech section of the BBC website to see all that in action.
Maddie, nice talking to you. Thank you very, very much indeed.
Thanks, Ian.
Take care. It's Maddie Moat if you want to send me a text. Hey. Oh, here we go. This is the sexy sax man.
What is going on?
This is, honestly, it is one of the funniest videos ever. It's the sexy sax man on... YouTube.
Okay.
And he just bursts into like a business meeting or a college lecture or a shopping centre, and he just starts playing Careless Whisper on the saxophone.
I'll be taking a look at Sexy Sax Man as soon as I get home.
Maddie, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Ian. Bye.
If you want to get in touch maybe with some bits and pieces that you found on YouTube, nothing can beat the Sexy Sax Man. Or what do you want from your technology? Do send me a text, 85058. In around about an hour's time, by the way, Auto Express Editor-in-Chief Steve Fowler will be here with motoring news. If you're thinking of buying or selling a car, then do get in touch. He knows everything. Text in your questions again to 85058 and you can get his advice. Right, it's coming up to, it's 8:30 exactly. Richard Foster has got the news.
And the British swimmer Michael Jameson has criticised the US anti-doping agency for what he feels is a lenient punishment to Tyson Gay.
I'm so glad you explained that swimming story, Chris, because all I saw was the headline the other day, Gay Swimming Scandal, and I got completely the wrong end of the stick. It was a gentleman's name, so that's, I'm glad that's all sorted out, which is all very exciting.
Did you delete your internet history?
No, I was wondering what it's all about. I just saw, you know, sometimes you pass a shop and the news is on and you don't, all you get is the headlines or the subtitles. I wonder what on earth was going on. Listen, you're going to stick around because we're talking, yeah. It's a very, very important day for football. I'm almost embarrassed to say this on Five Live, but I will. I don't really like football.
Ooh.
Let's not get off to a bad start, shall we? We can go back to our sports reporter Will Perry, who's been at Everton this evening to watch them play Manchester City, who according to their manager are now a step closer to winning the title. Manuel Pellegrini is especially pleased they came back from a great first Everton goal.
It's a great result because I think that was a very tough game. He thought from the beginning that Everton will play this game thinking and what they can do and not think if Liverpool wins the title, if they win today. I think that they play very well and congratulations. They started winning the game with an unbelievable goal, and that I think that was the character of the team that playing away against a very good team.
Will, how important was that win?
Yeah, evening, Ian. In the grand scheme of things, a really huge win for Manchester City, because here at Goodison Park, at Everton's ground, they've got a dreadful record before this. They've won just once in their last 15 games at Goodison Park. One win, four draws, 10 defeats as well. And they've lost their last four in a row. You know, Everton are a bogey team for Manchester City in recent years, both here and at Manchester City's ground, the Etihad Stadium. So when you look at the history, the fact that it didn't repeat itself, huge for Manchester City. The fact that it's still in their own hands. Now, all they've got to do, and I said that with a sort of cheeky smile to Manuel Pellegrini, smiled back, is beat Aston Villa on Wednesday night at the Etihad Stadium and beat West Ham on the final day. And barring a ridiculous goal swing for Liverpool, they will be champions for the second time in 2 years. So, huge in that sense.
Well, how important is... I hear people talking about, you know, they've never won at this stadium, or they've only won once, they've lost. How important is that psychologically when they're going to play there?
Do you know what? I thought that same thing as well until a few weeks ago. And I spoke to a couple of former players, and they told me that, you know, psychologically, you try and put this thing out of your mind, the fact that you have a poor record here and so on. But for the home team, it's so much more important. They know they've got that psychological edge over you. And you know, as a player, things remain in your head. You know you made a mistake here 2 years ago in that exact same position on the pitch. And you try and put that out of your head. But it's difficult to do that. And in a pressure situation where Manchester City were 3-2 up here with 25 minutes to go, and they were absolutely bums to the wall for those final 25 minutes. And who would want to be a manager? Manuel Pellegrini was stood there, and I spoke to Yaya Toure after the game. In his words, he said he didn't understand how Manuel Pellegrini didn't have a heart attack. Repeating his words, you know, he just says the pressure is so intense for City. They knew that if they drew this game, it goes right back to Liverpool. It's in Liverpool's hands. The fact that they've won it, of course, means that Liverpool can still win those two games, and City would win it on goal difference on the final day. There are still so many permutations, Ian. We won't even go into the fact that if City draw on Wednesday night, because, you know, they don't have to win on Wednesday night to win the title. It can go down to the final day. But listen, Manchester City fans will tell you that their team never, ever do things the easy way. You know, going back to when they went up in the old Division 2 against Gillingham in 1999, they did it in the 95th minute and then on penalties. Winning the league 2 years ago against QPR was probably the most dramatic game football scene, certainly in recent history. So they don't do it the easy way, but City in the prime position position now to win the league and to be champions for the second time in 2 years.
You need a degree in maths when it gets to this stage of the league. The title can be won by two teams, but at the bottom, there are two teams whose fates were sealed today, weren't there? A lot of disappointed people.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, Chelsea can still win the title as well, mathematically.
Oh, okay.
Highly unlikely, but they can as well. They play Norwich tomorrow. They have to win that one to still have a chance. Liverpool play Crystal Palace on Monday night. But yeah, down the bottom, Fulham and Cardiff confirmed that they'll be playing in the Championship next season. Cardiff, you know, kind of going down in a bit of a whimper, really, losing to Newcastle, at Newcastle as well, who'd been on a horrendous run. I think they'd lost six games on the trot, Newcastle, so they lost 3-0 Cardiff there. And as Mark Pugach described, Fulham going down like an octopus at Stoke, losing 4-1 there. And, you know, they spent a lot of money recently. They brought in Felix Magath, who's been a hugely successful manager all over Europe, and he hasn't managed to keep them up. So, you know, Fulham going down, it will be a huge loss, well, certainly to London football in that sense. But yeah, you do wonder, will they bounce back quickly? Have they got the infrastructure there? They've been up in that top division for so long. It'll be interesting to see how they cope. But yeah, Fulham and Cardiff confirmed that they'll be playing in the Championship next season.
And what about Sunderland?
Well, Sunderland in with a real chance. What a win that was at Manchester United. And you heard, I don't know if you heard earlier on Five Live, speaking to Ryan Giggs, you could really hear in his voice, I mean, the shock of that defeat. He wanted to win it, obviously, to be in with, albeit an unrealistic shout of getting the job at Manchester United, but he wanted to win those final three games as Manchester United boss. And Gus Poyet, I mean, you know, he's won at Chelsea, winning at Manchester United. They were bottom at Christmas, they were bottom on Boxing Day, no sides done it. All the jinx was there, all the omens were there, and they look like they could pull off the unthinkable at the moment. Norwich, Fulham and Cardiff in the bottom three. Norwich, as I say, playing at Chelsea tomorrow.
Will, just going to ask you one question. We've got 30 seconds. As someone who's not a fan of football, how can Manchester United forget how to be good in 9 months? How has that happened?
I'm going to open up a can of worms if I try and answer that seriously. But listen, Sir Alex Ferguson clearly put on 10-15 points onto that team every single season. Whether the players have decided that they're not giving 100% to the team, which is what people have suggested, I'm not so sure. I don't think that's possible when you've still got people like, you know, Ryan Giggs and all the guys behind the scenes like Phil Neville, who know that club inside out. Whether they wouldn't give that 100% for David Moyes, or whether it was Joe Bloggs or me managing the team, you know, the fact that they're now what, 7th in the table, 60 points, 9 points off Everton, who are in 5th place. Yeah, they'll struggle to get Europa League football. Well, they won't get Europa League football next season, United. That might be the best thing for them. It's going to be a hugely transitional stage for them this summer. Whether they get Louis van Gaal, who's been tipped to come in and replace David Moyes in the summer, hugely experienced manager, things will start to rebuild. One thing you do know with Manchester United, Liverpool fans won't like to hear it, Manchester City fans won't like to hear it, but they will come back stronger. They always do, no matter who's there. You know, Sir Alex Ferguson will have a big say in who's the next manager. That board will be working their socks off over the summer, and they'll be back to surprise a few, I'm sure, with Chelsea next season.
Will Perry, nice to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. I don't know all about football. How can a team that good forget how to be good in 9 months? I don't get it. If you know the answer, 85058, do send me a text. Also the number to text if you've got any car questions. We'll be talking cars a little bit later on. So any questions you've got, send me a text. Now, earlier this week, you heard about how 5 rare monkeys were stolen from Blackpool Zoo. Well, there's good news. Some good news. 4 of them have been found, but police in Lancashire are still trying to track down the 5th, who's only a baby. Well, earlier on, I spoke to Charlotte Penny, who's the head of primates at the zoo. She says it's been rather an unusual week.
Tuesday night, early hours of Wednesday morning, someone cut the perimeter fence of the zoo, went to 2 separate monkey houses. One was an emperor tamarin house and one was a cotton top tamarin house. And then they removed the screws out of the bolts that were on the door. Once the screws were removed, the bolt came away and therefore the door opened. And then they took 3 cotton top tamarins and 2 emperor tamarins from the zoo.
You must have been upset when you came in the next morning and saw what happened.
What I meant to say as well is when they'd actually finished and they'd taken the animals, they screwed the locks and the bolts all back on, so it looked like nobody had even been. So at first glance in the morning when we came in, we didn't notice anything, and obviously every morning we do a stock check of all our animals, and we realised there was a couple missing, and we thought, oh, maybe they're hiding in a bush, and then we checked the other ones and there were some others missing from there. And then when we actually realised they weren't in the enclosure and we looked further, we realised obviously somebody had broken in overnight.
Now, I'd imagine, Charlotte, as head of primates, you kind of develop quite a close relationship with them.
Yeah, you know, we work with these animals on a day-to-day basis, a couple of times a day. We try and leave them to be as wild as possible. But, you know, we are the people that make sure they're okay if they need any veterinary needs, or, you know, we feed them, we water them, we clean them. So you get to know the characters of the animals. You get to know them very well. And, you know, it was quite devastating when we found out that they'd actually been stolen.
It's quite an intricate robbery to cut through the wire, to unscrew doors, then to take the monkeys and then screw the doors again. This sounds like a very professional gang.
Definitely. You know, whoever did this has been in the zoo before. They've scouted out the zoo and they knew exactly what they were coming for. Where they'd cut the perimeter fence and walked through the zoo, they'd passed other small monkey houses, not bothered with them, and gone to these specific animals. So whoever it was were definitely wanting those animals and knew exactly what they were doing. The fact that they tried to cover it up afterwards, it is quite worrying, really.
Why would they do it? Is there a big black market in tamarins?
In 40 plus years that Blackpool Zoo's been open, we've never had any primates stolen, and it's not a common occurrence in all zoos. I'm not saying it's never happened, because it has, but the pet trade and private collectors, and these animals can be worth quite a lot of money, and unfortunately people take advantage of that, and we believe that somebody's taken it to either pass on through the pet trade to somebody else.
How many have come back, and how did you get them back?
I received a phone call late last night about 11 o'clock from our local police station, who said a member of the public had been in contact to say that there were some monkeys at their back door, basically.
Wow, what a... How cool would that be? There's a knock at the back door, you go and look and there are some monkeys there. That would be wonderful.
Well, the gentleman said that they were just there when he came home, so yes, it's very strange. And this was over in Yorkshire, so obviously that's quite away from the zoo. So obviously when I was speaking to the police, I asked them whether they could get the local police, obviously, to go and have a look and make sure the animals are there. And the Halifax police confirmed that they had taken the monkeys from the house and taken them back to the police station. And then about 2 o'clock this morning, myself and one of my colleagues went over to the police station to retrieve them.
The baby's still missing. I've been doing a little bit of Googling, and well, occasionally the mums kill the babies, don't they? Do you think that's happened, or do you think that the burglars have still got them?
I honestly couldn't say. We've got no evidence to say whether the animal is still alive with someone else or whether, you know, a fatality has happened to it. These animals, they don't deal with stress very well. And if they're in bad situations, then females with babies sometimes will kill the babies because, you know, they need to look after themselves and they can't look after them and a baby. So sometimes it does happen. You know, the baby was only 3.5 months old. So it has been taken away from its mum, you know, it probably won't last a long time. So fingers crossed.
You say they don't deal with stress well, Charlotte. How do you reintegrate them back into their group? Do you have to let them in gently? Is there some kind of monkey psychologist? How does it work?
They'd have been away weeks and months. It would have been quite difficult to mix them back into the group. The fact that they've been away a few days means actually benefits us. Obviously, when we brought the animals back to the zoo last night, we took them to our animal hospital and we kept them overnight there just to monitor them and obviously make sure that they were okay before we reintroduced them this morning. And before we actually let them into the group, the pet carriers that they were in, we placed those pet carriers within the enclosure so that the other animals can smell them and sniff them, and the behaviour they were giving off was very affectionate, and we left them like that for a small time and then released them back in, and straight away you could tell that they wanted them back in the group and there was no tension at all.
It's an incredible story, isn't it? That was Charlotte Penny, head of primates at Blackpool Zoo. This is Ian Lee sitting in for Chris, Saturday edition on BBC Five Live. If you want to take part, you can send me a text, 85058. It's 8:47.
On digital radio, digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Saturday edition.
Well, it's time to look at the week's news from the web. Helen Zaltzman is still away. Shame. Yet tech expert Rory Reid is here, though. Hello, Rory. How are you doing? You're right.
Second best.
Listen, don't you do yourself down, fella. Let's start with a couple of Twitter stories first. First, if you find certain people irritating on Twitter but don't want to block their account, you might be able to mute them instead. I don't get this, Rory. What is it?
All right. So the block function essentially cuts them off from your Twitter life forever. If you followed someone and you don't want to hear anything from them ever again, you can unfollow. But the mute function you don't have to unfollow them, you just shut them up, so you don't have to see the nonsense that they're talking for any given period of time. You can, for example, it's temporary, you can say, look, I don't want to hear anything from this person on this particular day, so I'm going to click mute next to their name, and suddenly any rants that they come out with that you have no interest in hearing whatsoever, and you don't want it clogging up your feed, you can mute that and their tweets don't show up.
What might they be saying that you don't want to read?
Wow, the possibilities are endless here. I mean, people often find the need to live tweet football matches, weekend. You know, they're watching a bit of sport and they're like, oh, Van Persie scored, get in. And if you happen to be a Manchester United fan and you don't want to necessarily spoil the result for yourself, then you might end up getting spoilers. And, you know, to unfollow someone because they occasionally post spoilers about sports events or movies might be a bit drastic. So the mute function is a great temporary measure to stop them spoiling anything that you don't want to hear in the short term.
This is at the trial stage, though, isn't it? We can't all go and mute people now.
No, it seems like it is a trial. Twitter hasn't commented specifically on its plans for rolling out the mute feature as yet. It's probably one of their so-called experiments. They published a blog post last year where they said that some users might start seeing new features while others don't see them because they're experimenting with new functionality all the time. And I think that's what's happened here. Selected users that are running Twitter's Apple iOS and Google Android apps have reported seeing the mute feature appear while others haven't. So
I think the thing I don't like about Twitter, they muffed up when they changed the block. Well, if I wanted to block someone in the past, I would block them and then they couldn't see my tweets. But if I block someone, they can still look at my tweets now, which I think is a little bit... I think that's a little bit unfair.
Yeah, I mean, it is a little bit, but Twitter is such a public, it's pretty much public. So anything that you put on Twitter, eventually you're going to start, you know, you're putting yourself in trouble, really.
Yeah, remember that, kids, when you're going for jobs, don't put stupid stuff on Twitter.
It's a social network for a reason.
Twitter are desperate, aren't they, for more people to spend more time on the service.
Yeah, I mean, they're a business. You know, people, they want people on the service in order for them to see adverts, in order for them to increase their revenue. And at the moment, they're trying to dream up other ways of doing it. And if they can perhaps introduce a feature like the mute function, which, you know, might have put some people off going on Twitter at all on a particular day, because they know that on Saturday people tweet things that are related to sports, for example, and they don't want to ruin the sports results, then this is another excuse for people to stay on the service and maybe soak up more adverts.
Well, it comes as Twitter have announced this week, and they kind of kept this one a little bit quiet, that people aren't signing up at quite the rate they would have hoped. It's sort of reached a plateau, hasn't it?
Yeah, they're experiencing slower than usual growth at the moment. People have historically been, you know, signing up in droves, but fewer people are signing up right now, probably because, you know, most of the people that want Twitter already have it, so it's hard to keep growing at the same rate they were previously. The number of active users is now up to about 255 million in the first 3 months of 2014, so that's like a 5.8% growth, and that's not fantastic, but again, you know, what's happened as a result is that people are kind of looking at it going, is this kind of the beginning of the end for Twitter? Is there no more growth for the service to experience? Is there no more money to be made?
And their share price took a hit as a result, didn't it?
Yeah, didn't look good. I think it was something like an 11% hit that their share prices fell, and they actually, you know, almost more importantly, their latest financial results, it was revealed they lost £78 million.
Hey,
so that's not looking good for them.
Do you
at the
moment. Think, Roy? Do you think people are getting bored of things like Twitter and Facebook? Here's a confession: this week I deleted my personal Facebook page.
You'll be back. You'll be back.
No, I've deleted it properly. I'm just bored of it. I'm spending so much time on it, and now I've got rid of it. Hey, guess what? I'm doing more stuff in the real world. Do you think people are getting a bit bored of them?
Yeah, but think about the stuff you're missing out on that you're not aware of. Personally, I hear this argument all the time. A lot of people say, oh my God, Facebook is such a waste of time. It's a time suck. I'm not getting stuff done out there in the real world. And they disappear from the service for a month, 2 months. They always come back, every single one of them.
That sounds like fighting talk to me.
I think you'll be back. I'm 100% sure you'll come back. comeback.
Twitter, I mean, Twitter, we say it's slowing down, but what did you say, 255 million people? That's still huge, isn't
active,
it?
Active, well, it is and it isn't. 225 active users right now, but total registered users is a billion. That means only about a quarter of people who sign up actually bother to use it. So it's like, you know, all these people have signed up and they're like, oh, I've seen it and it's not that great. I'm out, basically. It's not quite as mainstream as, say, Facebook, for example. It's used mainly by people who want to promote things. So businesses, and a lot of those businesses just because they think they should be on it, but not necessarily because they know exactly what to do with it.
Oh, those adverts on Twitter, they so often backfire, don't they? Chief Executive Dick Costello says big events like the Oscars are still bringing new people to the service.
In the 2 days after the Oscars, there were over 3.3 billion views of tweets just about the show. That kind of reach and impact is why we now have TV measurement and ratings partnerships in 11 countries. And it's what's enabled us to build a partnership with Billboard for the first real-time chart to highlight the music of the moment.
Do send me a text if you feel you're getting a bit bored of Twitter and Facebook. Hey, I wonder how Tom from MySpace is doing. Remember that guy? when the man behind films like these makes predictions for the future of movie watching, well, it's probably worth listening.
If you think this whole mad scene ain't dope, or what I'm saying ain't straight tripping, just say, oh, no, you didn't, then I'll know it's whack.
How do we move through Europe without attracting attention?
Wait! The circuit is
turned. Is for circus animals only.
This could be the end of Kung Fu.
But I just got Kung Fu!
And now you must save it. Take the five. It is time for the next phase of your journey. My fist hungers for justice.
That's my fist. Oh.
Excuse me, I do apologise, Kung Fu Panda. Shrek, Madagascar, Kung Fu Panda, all from DreamWorks Animations, whose head this week said that the cost of watching a newly released film will in the future depend on the size of the screen you're watching. So what does this mean? They're cheap on a phone, a fortune if it's on a proper telly?
Yeah, you got it in a nutshell. Oh. Basically, what he proposes is that a movie at the cinema will be $15. A movie on a 75-inch TV will be $4, and on a smartphone, it'll be $1.99. So, you know, you're paying more to experience it on a bigger screen, but less if you're going to experience it on a smaller screen.
How easy is it to identify the size of screen being used?
In principle, it's fairly easy. Every device is able to kind of communicate what kind of gadget it is, whether it's a phone or a TV or whatever else. And every gadget connected to the internet has an IP address, their own unique identifier. So it shouldn't be a big deal to identify what's connecting and requesting the movie. Like, you know, iTunes knows exactly what you're logging into the service with, and it's able to limit the number of devices that you connect with. But that's in principle. There's always a way around these things. To make it work, they're going to need some pretty robust digital rights management, DRM. For example, like, you know, BBC iPlayer, it's only meant for use in the UK, and yet people still find ways to access it outside the UK. So there's always a means.
Rory, we're almost out of time. There's one story that has intrigued me. Odd goings on YouTube with someone or something has uploaded tens of thousands of videos of coloured rectangles put to this eerie music. Sounds fun, huh? You could dance to that all night. The videos last 11 seconds. There have been 77,000 of them have been uploaded so far. What on earth is this?
It's weird. Whoever's been doing this has been doing it since September 23rd, right? And it's been going on for months. And they whoever it is never eats, never sleeps. They just continue to upload movies over and over again. Over Christmas, they were uploading a video every 2 minutes on average. And every single one of these videos looks almost exactly the same, but not quite. They all follow the same pattern. It's like a red rectangle and a blue rectangle and this weird noise, and people have been trying to figure out exactly what it is. There have been lots of conspiracy theories about whether there's people trying to communicate with aliens, whether it's some kind of secret number station test where people broadcast unintelligible lists of numbers or letters in code for people to try and crack the code and then secretly recruit them for their own nefarious purposes. It's very, very bizarre.
Do we have any idea? I mean, I was reading about this, and since I saw this and heard about this, I've been doing my own research, and apparently one of the videos has changed, and one of them is a video of the Eiffel Tower that lasts for 7 seconds, and then it went back to these weird shapes and tones. Do we have any idea what it is?
Yeah, we're thinking that what it is is that it's basically a company needed to be able to find a way to quickly and reliably upload a digital video, and then test that video with random snippets to run image recognition software on it. So it's basically a company trying to figure out the best way to set up their set-top box. And the way that they're doing that is just to test it through YouTube. So it's pretty boring, actually, but I prefer the alien theory myself.
Yeah, I prefer the alien theory, or like something from Lost, you know, some weird signals being sent to a load of spies or something.
Well, it's still, maybe it is. Maybe the excuse they've given us is the mundane answer, but the truth is a little bit more mysterious.
I am liking your style, sir. I'm digging the conspiracy theory. Rory, lovely to talk to you, mate. Thank you very, very much.
You too. Thanks very much.
Excellent stuff. That's Rory Reid there. If you do want to send me a text and get in touch with the show, you're more than welcome to. 85058 is the text number. Looking for what technology you would like to have, what's missing that should be there. And also, coming up a bit later on in the show, we'll be talking cars. So if you've got any questions about cars, maybe you're buying, maybe you're selling, I don't know, then send me a text, 85058. And we will put your questions to our car expert.
Coming up next on 5 Live.
He's doing me out of a job. Coming up after 9, we'll be at the 10th annual Eve Fest in Reykjavik, so you don't have to be. Our gaming guru, Guy Cock, is there, and we'll also hear about the thousands of copies of our Atari's E.T. game that have been found in the Arizona desert. It's one of the gaming's biggest mysteries. It may now be solved.
First for breaking news and the best live sport. This is BBC 5 Live.
It's 9 o'clock on 5 Live. This is Ian Lee with Saturday Edition. As I said, Steve Fowler from Auto Express is going to be here at about 9:45. If you're buying or selling a car, he's the man to ask. Text him now. Always gets very busy. Text him your questions, 85058. We're also asking if you've given up on social networks. Mark in Derry has got in touch and said, I deleted my Facebook account last August. Did not take long to realise who my real friends were. More on that a bit later on, but right now Richard Foster has got the news.
This is BBC 5 Live on digital, online, smartphone and tablet.
Hello, this is Ian Lee sitting in for Chris on Saturday Edition. Don't panic, it's only for 1 week. Don't get your knickers in a twist. We're still sticking to the same kind of format as well. You know, we're talking games, we're talking tech. Hey, coming up in a little bit, I have to confess, let me put my cards on the table. I am a gaming geek and I'm particularly a retro gaming geek. We're going to be talking about a story a little bit later on, which I always thought was a myth. It was the great gaming crash of what? I think 1983. It's almost sent Atari bust. It almost ended video games. One game called E.T. that was, well, it was supposed to have been buried in the Mexican desert. I didn't believe this, but, well, someone may have found it. If you want to get in touch with anything we're talking about, about video games. We'll also be talking about cars a little bit later on. I'm not a car expert. All I know is I've got a car that gets me from A to B. That'll do. Thank you very much indeed. But if you've got a question about cars, maybe you're buying or you're selling one, we have got a car expert coming in a little bit later on. It always gets very, very busy, so I suggest you start sending texts now, please. 85058 with your car questions, we'll put them to our car expert a little bit later on. Now, yesterday, the High Court ruled that British soldiers could and should not hold prisoners in Afghanistan for longer than 4 days because it would be a breach of their captives' human rights. The case was brought against the Ministry of Defence by 4 men who were all held for longer than 96 hours. And now they're going to receive money in compensation. Keen to get your thoughts on this. Do you think we should be giving out compensation for this kind of thing? 85058. Well, speaking after the ruling, the Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, said they'd appeal the decision.
Detention is an essential part of our combat operations. It's essential to complete our mission. It's essential to protect our forces. We have to be able to detain those who are trying to kill or maim British forces or indeed Afghan civilians. And I'm disappointed because the ruling the judge has made that the ECHR applies to our troops in combat operations could seriously undermine our ability to conduct those operations. So we will appeal the judgment, and if at the end of what will be a long legal process we are unable to overturn it, we will have to look at other ways of ensuring that our forces, when they go into battle, do not have two hands tied behind their back.
Well, that's Defence Secretary Philip Hammond speaking there. I'm interested to get your thoughts on this. In a battle situation, should there be no rules? Do we have to put the troops' safety first, or do we have to abide by the rules? 85058. Well, earlier on, I spoke to Phil Shiner. He's from Public Interest Lawyers, and he represents three of the four men who brought this case against the Ministry of Defence.
In Afghanistan, we're there under a UN mandate as part of the International Security and Assistance Force, and ISAF has a policy of only detaining for 96 hours, and the judge found there was no lawful basis whatsoever for the UK alone to detain purposes of interrogation beyond that 96 hours.
One of your clients was held on suspicion of being a Taliban commander, weren't they?
One of my clients was, yes, but my clients deny that they are anything to do with the Taliban. The other two were not held on suspicion of being Taliban.
How much is this going to cost to pay them compensation?
That's for another day. Ultimately, though, this case was not about compensation. My claims were judicial review, and they were about establishing what the law allows and what the law does not allow, and the law does not allow us to detain beyond 96 hours in Afghanistan.
The reason I'm asking about the money is because there will be people listening to this who will be angry that, let's assume it's thousands of pounds, could be paid to people who've been captured and questioned in a battle zone.
If anyone's angry, I think they should be angry with the MOD, who knew full well, and they had legal advice that said they couldn't do this, but they went ahead anyway. We live in a democracy. We abide by the rule of law, or at least we say we do. And my clients were detained, on average, for nearly 300 days. Yes, it is costly. If you were locked up for 300 days unlawfully, it's going to cost them money, whoever's locked you up.
If the troops are in a very dangerous place, as Afghanistan is, should they be considering the intricacies of British law? If they're trying to catch people who they suspect of being the Taliban, who they suspect of being the enemy, should they be there kind of going, well, hang on a second, we've only got another hour, then we have to let them go? They want to make the place safe, don't they?
Well, to answer your question, if we don't like the policy of the International Security and Assistance Force and of the UN, then perhaps we should pull out. But we're part of ISAF, and those are the rules. No point complaining. And furthermore, we have signed up to the European Convention on Human Rights. And Article 5 of the European Convention on Human Rights provides that you can't be locked up without due process, without coming before a judge, without having a proper opportunity to know what the charges are against you and to challenge them and to put your case. That's the law. That's the price we pay for living in a democracy. If people don't want to live in a democracy, perhaps they should go and live in a country where there isn't.
In Afghanistan?
Well, perhaps so, yes. If they don't like living in Britain, where we have a democracy and we have a legal aid system and we have a human rights act, perhaps they should go and live somewhere else.
Philip Hammond, the Defence Secretary, said he was disappointed by the decision. He also said we can't send our armed forces into battle with both hands tied behind their backs. What's your reaction to that, Phil?
That's just empty rhetoric. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is, as Philip Hammond well knows, this is the umpteenth case from Iraq or Afghanistan where the Ministry of Defence have fallen flat on their face. Everything they try to avoid the impact of the law fails. The simple solution is to ensure that when our armed forces personnel serve abroad, they're trained properly and that they are trained in what the law is, not as a law student, but in the same way as the civilian police have to pass a basic legal test, then why not our armed forces personnel? The world wouldn't end. It wouldn't cost anything. Why don't we train them what the lines in the sand are and that they should abide by them? And if they don't, there will be consequences for them.
There will be people thinking, supposing they did get some bloke in Afghanistan who they thought was the Taliban, that they questioned him and after 96 hours they let him go and then he came back the next day and shot them all. That is a possibility, isn't it, in a battle zone?
No. If they follow the policy, then they will hand them over to a safe Afghan facility, and the Afghans can deal with them. We're supposed to be there to help the Afghan government restore law and order. We're not there as an occupier, so we hand them over to a safe Afghan facility where we know that the Afghans won't torture them or otherwise seriously violate their human rights. That's the solution.
Finally, Phil, this opens the floodgates, doesn't it, for other people, potentially hundreds of other people, I would imagine, to claim compensation from the British taxpayer?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm acting for three. There were many more, but they were hoodwinked into putting their fingerprint on a consent form, so they were transferred about 6 months ago or more to a facility where I have no idea where they are. You're right to say, but sadly, we thought it was a good idea to hold without charge, i.e. in turn, for the purpose of interrogation, many, many more. I'm only acting for three. I can't speak for any others. So I think floodgates is not a helpful term.
That was Phil Shiner talking to me earlier. If you want to have your say on that, you're more than welcome to 85058. By the way, if you don't recognise this voice, Chris is off this week. This is Ian Lee sitting in for Chris on Saturday edition. Coming up before the end of the show, we will be talking cars. If you've got any, now's the time to get some free advice, basically, kids, is what I'm saying. If you've any questions about cars, buying cars, selling cars, anything like that, do send us a text, 85058. It gets very, very busy, this part of the show, so get your text in soon if you want a chance of getting it read out on the air or you coming on the air. Coming up, we're going live to Reykjavik. Isn't it exciting? This is BBC Five Live. It's 9:13.
On digital radio, digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Saturday edition.
Now, every few weeks on Saturday edition, we cover gaming. That's with games journalist Guy Cocker. This week, he's in Reykjavik. Guy, can you hear us?
Hello, Ian. I can hear you loud and clear. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. It's nice to talk to you. I know we've had a mad panic, both ends, trying to get the line all up and running, but I'm glad it's working. What on earth are you doing in Reykjavik, you jammy so-and-so?
So this tiny island of 350,000 people has made one of the biggest online games of the last 10 years. It's been going for 10 years. It's called EVE Online, and I'm here checking out how the game's progressing. And also, they're making games for virtual reality headsets, which are going to be the next big thing in gaming. So I'm checking those out, and we'll talk about them in a little bit.
I'm aware of Eve. I did not know it was from Reykjavik. We'll talk about that in a second. But let's start with the chart as compiled by Track. Now, at number five, a third week in the top five for Lego The Hobbit. These Lego games, whether you like the films or not, they're generally pretty good, aren't they?
They are. Ian, I need to put my hands up and say I haven't actually had a chance to play this one or even see the movie, unfortunately. I've been missing out. I've been way too busy travelling the world. But Lego The Hobbit has done fairly well. It slipped this week. But like you say, those Lego games are as popular as ever. And they're usually good quality. They're good games for like parents and kids as well, I would say.
Did you just use the line, I've been far too busy travelling the world?
It's a busy life as a games journalist, Ian.
Oh, man, it wasn't when I was doing it. Number four, FIFA 14. This never leaves the chart, does it?
It never does. It's been another mega successful year for EA Sports and its biggest official sports franchise. We'll get to another FIFA-related game in the top five in a couple of places.
And number three, another huge franchise, Call of Duty Ghosts.
Yeah, so Call of Duty Ghosts hasn't been quite as popular as the previous Call of Duties. You know, there's other games sort of nipping at the heels, including Battlefield 4. But we'll be talking about the latest game in the series. But for now, yeah, Call of Duty Ghosts is in at number three.
The other FIFA title, EA are cashing in on the World Cup, FIFA World Cup Brazil, the second biggest seller this week. I always find these championship-specific FIFA games, they're never really that good, I don't think.
No, I mean, I get into the spirit of it. I get into it, you know, taking, in my case, England through to the World Cup finals is always a bit of a pleasure. In this particular one, you're going to be able to replicate. So when the actual finals are on, which is in June, I believe, they're going to be, you know, if for whatever reason the worst happens and England lose their match, you can then replay that particular real life scenario out in the game and kind of change the course of history
and get thrashed again. And number one, the bestseller this week, Titanfall.
Yeah, Titanfall keeps going back in at number one. So it's not been that the sales in the games market have fallen quite a lot this week, quite dramatically. So it's lost 41% of its sales, but it's still enough to keep a third straight week at number one. And it's fourth in total since launch. I don't know if you've played it, Ian. It's a really, really enjoyable game. It's sort of shaking up that, you know, well-worn shooter genre at this stage.
Do you know, I've not had a go on it. I do need
you
to.
Should.
Move on to the gaming news. You're in Reykjavik. It's Eve's 10th fan fest. For those who don't know what Eve is, just give us a brief description.
So, it's a massively multiplayer online game, and the hook is that it's this space-themed game, so it allows, it's about 500,000 people who subscribe to this game every month, they pay around £8 a month, to live out those kind of boyhood, for me at least, space fantasies. You know, you can build ships, you can take them on missions, you can perform a variety of different tasks. If you want to be a member of the government, you can do that. If you want to go mining for ore, you can do that. And the big story for this particular game that people might have seen on the BBC in January was there are these epic space battles which happen, and they cause hundreds of thousands of pounds of real damage. So, you know, these ships that you build, they take so much work to actually make that their equivalent value in the real world could be up to about £4,000.
But hang on,
these epic battles get blown up.
Hang on a second, because I played Eve a long, long time ago when it launched. How is it costing people thousands of pounds?
Well, basically, it has its own economic system. It has its own currency, ISK, which is actually the same currency they have in Iceland.
Clever.
And basically it costs that amount of money. You have to spend that amount of time in the game mining for resources.
Oh, okay.
You can actually spend real money to buy currency in the game, but that's the rough value, both in time and in actual currency. It's an economic nightmare in terms of they've got an in-house economics master to actually work all this sort of stuff out.
Blimey.
But basically they have these epic battles, loads of people get involved in them. It is allowing a load of people to live out their sort of space dreams and own these ships, like city-sized ships that take months to build. And it's quite a cute little game in terms of how you know, these 500,000 people fly over from all over the world to this tiny island, to Iceland, to go and check it out, and they're really, really into it.
It's a cracking game. The equivalent for old people like me is, do you remember Elite? Did you ever play Elite on a Spectrum or a BBC?
Absolutely. These guys say that Elite, which is a British game, big success story from about 20 years ago, this is the game that they modelled it on, but they've taken it into the massively multiplayer space.
What news has there been about the new instalment, Eve Valkyrie?
So Eve Valkyrie is the big exciting thing as far as I'm concerned. So next year, we think anyway, nothing's been announced, VR headsets are going to be coming in. The big one is the Oculus headset. The big news around this is that it was bought by Facebook for $4 billion a couple of weeks ago. Sony's also getting in the game. I've played with both of them in the last week, and there's a chance that this VR future could stall yet again, as it has done over the last 20 years again and again. But from what I've played of it, and in my professional opinion, this is the most exciting thing that's happening in gaming. I spoke to the guys from Eve. They're making Eve Valkyrie for these virtual reality platforms, and they announced the fact that Katie Sackhoff, a famous sci-fi actress, has been signed up.
It just makes the level of immersion so much greater than anything you experience in a typical game. That may be too intense for some gamers, and that's totally fine, but it also can be just a much more rewarding experience, and particularly for us with this idea of making the highest fidelity virtual worlds, you know, VR technologies becomes more accessible to more and more people, just pushes that mission along. It also leads us to do things a little differently with Valkyrie than we have with other games, where, for example, you know, the part of the immersion that is so important is the audio and the voices that you hear, and to that end, of course, we knew that if we wanted to make Valkyrie a great spaceship dogfighting game, we needed to get the right actress to voice our lead character there, and that of course led to the partnership with Katie Sackhoff that we announced on Thursday. A terrific, you know, just sort of if you imagine in your mind, you know, who is the right person to be that leader of the Valkyries, it would be hard to find a better person. And you have to do it with a mindset of making that virtual world feel as real as you possibly can.
And in case it's not apparent enough by the fact that people are willing to travel to Iceland for a game, fans, they take this really seriously, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I spoke to a cute little couple, which we're going to hear from now. They met each other in one of the offshoot games, which is called Dust 514, which is a shooter for PlayStation 3. It's a free-to-play shooter. They met for the, I think, the second time at this FanFest convention here in Iceland. They're getting married soon. Very, very adorable. But what the guy in the relationship, he told me about how he's building a Titan at the moment, and just wait until you hear how much he's spent on it.
She's inbuilt as we speak. I think it comes out of build roughly 3 days before the new patches come out, which I think is June the 3rd. So it comes out maybe 3 days before then. Right. So it could be being attacked right now. You know, I could be sat here and it's being blown up as we speak. But I mean, I think the Titan's equivalent in real money to about, I think it's 3,000, maybe £400, 4,000 pounds, sorry.
And then about $6,000.
Yeah. So they're not, you don't enter it without you knowing what an extreme risk it is, put it that way. And like I said in the beginning, it's one of the reasons that draws me to Eve is the ability to put so much effort into it. And I know it sounds really strange to say, well, why would you want to lose something like that? But until you play a computer game and you realise that, yeah, okay, you can lose something and you're still going to be sat there at the end of the day, you know, but your heart's racing and everything else, then that's why we do it. Definitely for the risk and the reward.
Guy, there'll be some people listening and going, oh dear, how sad. But I think that's really charming. I think that's lovely.
It is. So the audience of people that play this game is like 98% male.
This
so the
a surprise.
Fact that he's found a girl in this universe is surprising enough. Let alone that she's marrying him. But it was adorable. They're getting married and they're going to go. She's going to move from, I think it was Minnesota in the States, to Sheffield in the United Kingdom.
Oh,
so that'll be quite a shift.
it will be a surprise. Well, good for them. I think that's nice. Hey, now listen. This is something that most people will never have heard in their lives. Have a listen to this. You might recognise the tune, but not where it's coming from. It's Atari's 1980s game, E.T. It was a disaster. It's the game that pretty much ruined Atari. It almost ruined video games until the Japanese kicked off with Nintendo. And archaeologists have unearthed thousands of cartridges that were apparently dumped out of shame in the Arizona desert back in 1983. Here's Larry Harib, who's been involved in a documentary about the dig.
Back in the 80s, over 30 years ago, the backstory is that Atari had rushed this particular game, this E.T. game, into production, and the developer, whom I had a lovely chat with when I was down at the site, he was there, had about 5 weeks to make it. Now, by any stretch of the imagination, 5 weeks is nowhere near enough time to make a game at all. So the game was released, and there was a lot of things that happened with this game that kind of were really bad. For one, the game only had 5 weeks. Number two, they produced far more cartridges for the 2600 than there were even in existence at that time. And then, of course, the game itself was not well received, and Atari decided to take the loss, cart them out into the desert, and put them into a landfill.
I love it. It was a bad game, wasn't it, Guy?
It was awful. It's one of the worst games ever made. It's pretty well accepted. This back in the 80s, a lot of people were saying that the video game's just a fad and they were going to die out. And this was the death knell of the video games industry. And yeah, it became the stuff of legend that Atari dumped all these cartridges in the desert.
Well,
I
thought the dumping was a myth, Guy. I didn't know it actually happened.
Well, this documentary team who are making a documentary for the Xbox Live gaming channel, so it's not for TV, which is another interesting point. They went and they got permission to go into the desert and go and dig these up. They only had a day to do it, so they didn't have long, and they found evidence of the cartridges there. They'd obviously, they'd been there since the 80s, so they weren't all intact and in their cases, but they found evidence of them being there, which has kind of proven this urban myth that yes, Atari did dump them in the desert because they made too many and it was awful. And even back then, there were a lot of bad games being made, but the gaming public wouldn't swallow such a bad game.
And you say, yeah, this is being shown on Xbox Live's gaming channel. They're creating original content, are they?
They are, yeah. They're like Netflix and Love Film, Amazon. In a lot of ways, they're getting into the TV production space, which makes sense because a lot of people do watch Sky and BBC iPlayer through their Xbox consoles. So it's the next logical step for them, I think. So yeah, watch out for more of this.
Okay, we mentioned Call of Duty. The new Call of Duty has been shown off for the first time.
Democracy, democracy.
Democracy is not what these people need. Hell, it's not even what they want. America's been trying to install democracies in nations for a century, and it hasn't worked one time. Give me a break.
I think this show is being sponsored by Kevin Spacey tonight. He gets everywhere, doesn't he?
he is in everything at the moment. Yeah, he's doing well. He's looking slightly computerized and a little bit plasticky in this trailer, if
it's
I'm being
honest.
It's his
face as well, is it?
It is, yeah, it's his likeness. So the latest Call of Duty, now Call of Duty, it should be said, has been going for a good sort of 10 years now. It may be getting a little bit tired. So they've injected a famous Hollywood actor. His likeness and his voice looks just like Kevin Spacey, like I said, just maybe a little bit more plasticky than his House of Cards appearance. And this is the latest one. It's focusing on private military contractors.
Does it look any good? Because Call of Duty has dominated the market for a long, long time. But you're right, there are so many good competitors now, and quite often the Call of Duty games, it's hard to tell them apart.
They do sort of mesh into one. I mean, there's two components really to the Call of Duty experience. One is the single player game, which a lot of gamers that I know don't really bother with these days. They just sort of, they don't even go and play it at all. They just get into the multiplayer experience. And I think it's got to the point where a lot of people feel daunted by the sheer quality of Call of Duty players that are out there now. They buy every year, they get really into it, they are kind of unbeatable. And Call of Duty is kind of, if I'm being honest, it's gotten a bit stale in the face of competition. Titanfall's come in and shook up the market with massive mechs and wall running, and if I'm honest, Call of Duty does look like it's stealing some of that in terms of its as I said, it focuses on private military contractors. It has these sort of augmented soldiers with all these technology and gadgets, basically, and it looks like it's taking a leaf out of Titanfall's book.
You're right. The online Call of Duty, you're just getting pasted by a load of 14-year-old American kids. You just, as soon as you spawn, you get taken out. It's impossible.
Well, you know, obviously, I'm a great Call of Duty player.
Oh, right? Here we go.
Maybe that happens in your case, but yeah, no, it does happen to me. Honestly, it's even as someone who plays video games a lot. Yeah, there are kids out there that spend so much time on this. It's difficult to compete. But then again, it's the same in FIFA, and it's the same in a lot of other online games as well.
It's interesting as well, Kevin Spacey in that, Katie Sackhoff in the other games. It has been the last year or so, last couple of years maybe, that actors have started to take video games seriously, and they're getting good quality, good caliber people in those games, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. And I, you know, speaking frankly, I don't know whether it's, you know, them being used. I mean, Kevin Spacey's a great actor, but I don't know whether he's being used for the name to add a little bit of weight to the story. The Call of Duty series in particular has hired the last game was written by the writer of Traffic, which was an Oscar nominated picture, or I think it might have even won the Oscar. But it was, I think the guys that made Grand Theft Auto, Rockstar Games, who write all the games in house, but fully understand the way that video games work as a medium, and they're obviously influenced by the likes of Scorsese films and Francis Ford Coppola films. I think those guys are the best example of storytelling right now, and The Last of Us as well, which I don't know if you've played, Ian. Those are at the current forefront of storytelling, not Call of Duty.
Guy, let's have a quick look at your picks for the week as ever. One for the friends, one for the family, and one to take over your life. Let's start with your one for friends.
So one for friends this week is Mario Golf World Tour. I've picked a Nintendo 3DS title. There hasn't been that many new releases on that platform recently. So Nintendo has once again taken a famous sport. They've done tennis in the past. This is now golf. It's infused with a kind of wacky Mario-esque flavour. So there are those big yellow boxes to kind of collect and coins to collect. But I found, you know, I've been playing this quite a lot on my travels recently. It fails to kind of offer that long-term reward, I found. It was maybe a little bit gimmicky and it didn't really keep me going. I prefer a more serious golf experience personally, like Tiger Woods.
Okay, one for mates.
So one for family this week is Amazing Spider-Man 2.
Oh, sorry, Spider-Man, I do apologize. Yes, I'm all, one for family, yes, go on.
Yeah, no worries, yeah, it's Amazing Spider-Man 2. So obviously the film is dominating the box office charts at the moment. Spider-Man games traditionally are either really good or really bad, and this one actually, this one falls somewhere in the middle. The swinging mechanic works really, really well. It's a joy to just sort of explore Manhattan and swing around. It uses both triggers to kind of, you know, mimic the arm movements that Spider-Man makes, and it's good fun. Everything else else is pretty much ripped off of other games. So you've got the combat mechanics from the Arkham games, which are absolutely fantastic, the Batman Arkham games, the stealth sequences, again, from Batman Arkham. It's one of those games that is not very memorable at all. If you're a massive Spider-Man fan, you might get something out of it, but it didn't really add to the experience. I would go and see the movie instead.
Guy, we've got 20 seconds. One to take over your life, please.
So this is Hitman Go on the iPad. The iPad has had some fantastic games recently. Monument Valley, even Surgeon Simulator. Hitman Go is another instant classic, I'd say. It's unlike the game that you might have played on PlayStation and Xbox, but it's kind of takes that Agent 47 stealth mechanic. You've got to be methodical, precise, and discreet, and it's a really, really enjoyable game. It's very different, but very, very fun.
Guy, excellent stuff. Thank you. Guy Cocker, games journalist at the EVE Fan Fest in Reykjavik. Thank you very much indeed. We're asking today, this evening, are you bored of social networks? Dave has texted in. He's had enough of Facebook like me. He says, I shut down my Facebook months ago. I was sick of trawling through piles of rubbish and photos of food and drink and getting friend requests from people I don't even speak to in real life. If you want to send me a text about that, or if you've got a question about cars, then do get in touch. 85058. It's 9:32. Richard Foster has got the news.
Across the UK.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Saturday edition.
Evening, this is Ian Lee sitting in for Chris. I think I'm getting away with it. I think I'm just about getting away with it. I've not had a torrent of abuse on the text saying, get rid of this Muppet. So in my mind, I'm doing all right. We'll be talking in a second to Steve to find out about cars. Steve Fowler, the editor-in-chief of Auto Express. If you've got car questions, we could probably maybe squeeze in one or two more. So send in a text, 85058. But before that, there are reports tonight that at least three people have died following two explosions in Mombasa in North Kenya. The authorities say the fatalities were caused by the first blast, which took place on board a bus. The other one went off near a resort hotel on the coast. Now, we're joined now by Mohammed Hersey. He's the chair of the Mombasa Coast and Tourist Association. Hello, Mohammed.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Well, I'm doing very well, but what's happened? What can you tell us?
Well, it was around about 6 p.m. local time, that's around 5 hours ago. In the evening, the first incident happened on the north coast at the Reef Hotel. This is an incident where someone left an unattended bag at the beach bar, which stayed there for a while. And the security team and the staff, who are now very alert on such a suspicious baggage, decided to transfer that particular bag and hand it over to security at the entry, which is at the entrance of the hotel. So it was transferred there, and in the process of inspecting the bag, they discovered that there was a device inside. And you'll notice that this has happened quite often in Kenya, so we are all very alert now to the improvised explosive devices. So when they noticed that, they decided to take cover and it exploded. Fortunately, no one was hurt and there were no casualties, and the blast did not take place inside the hotel. It happened outside at the central room, and there was no damage as such. That was the first one. And the second one happened in town, where someone had a device at a crowd that was waiting for a bus. Unfortunately, three people lost their lives. But everything is back to normal. It is calm again. And security team now have taken it up to try and investigate and see who are behind it and what they will do to the next and the ones now to tell us. I can say clearly is that refocus the staff and the guests are all safe and intact.
Mohammed, listen, we're going to leave it there. It's not the best line at all, but I think we managed to get your message across. It was interesting, wasn't it? He was saying that they're kind of used to finding bags with explosives in. Oh, my goodness. Mohammed Hersey, chair of the Mombasa Coast and Tourist Association. No doubt we'll have more on that throughout the evening on BBC Five Live. This is Ian Lee sitting in for Chris. It's Saturday edition. It's 9:41.
On digital radio, digital TV, downloads and online.
This is BBC Radio Five Live. Saturday edition. We'll be right back.
joined now by Steve Fowler, the editor-in-chief of Auto Express. He's here for his regular look at motoring news. We'll have his Cars of the Week shortly. But, well, first of all, let's say hello to Steve. Hello, Steve. How are you doing? You all right?
Very well. How are you, Ian?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I'm tempted just to shut up and let the Queens of the Stone Age play
great,
for the next 20. I've not heard this for
ages. I've lucked out with my little bit of music.
I know. You've done much better than the others. let's have a look at the questions that we've got from you. We've got Paul from Ammanford has texted in. I do approximately 400 miles a week, mainly on the motorway. Is a BMW Efficient Dynamics a sensible option? Now, of course, I know the answer to that, but Steve, I'm going to let you answer it.
Well, the Efficient Dynamics are the really economical diesel models that BMW do, and they really own that sort of thing at the moment. And yes, the bottom line is it would be a great option. The one thing I would say, a car that we've driven, I might talk a little bit about later on is the Audi A6 Ultra. I think Audi have obviously seen what BMW are doing with Efficient Dynamics and thought, well, we need a bit of that. So the A6 Ultra, and there'll be an A4 Ultra, they're basically cars that are very economical, low CO2. The best thing about the BMWs, they still feel like BMWs. They're good to drive, they're comfortable, which you're going to need if you're doing 400 miles a week up and down the motorway. So yeah, BMW Efficient Dynamics are great. Have a look at the Audi A6 Ultras too.
Being the editor in chief of Auto Express, do you know everything about every car? Well, have you got like a little blind spot? There's, for example, the Nissan Micra you don't know anything about.
Don't ask me about the Nissan Micra. Oh. No, you're going to catch me out, aren't you? But
I'm not tempted. I just wondered if you're ever thrown, or you can pretty much, you've got an answer for pretty much every car.
I've got a politician's answer. I'll just carry on speaking. I've been into cars for years, so okay. It helps.
Paul in Toaster has texted in 85058. This is an interesting one. Is there any point in buying a car? Well, yeah, because then you own a car, Paul.
Helps you get around.
It does, because the amount you lose in value in the first year is mental. Is hire purchase or continual car scheme renewal not a better option, as you can replace your car every 3 years with these schemes? I paid 20 grand cash for a Land Rover. It lost 10k in value in 2 years.
Well, you're not going to be able to get away from the fact that cars depreciate, new cars depreciate, and if you look at it as a curve, as a graph, as they get older, they depreciate less. So if you buy a slightly older car, you're going to suffer less depreciation. But buying a new car is going to depreciate. Whatever finance you do it on, the car is still going to depreciate. Now, I'm a big fan of personal contract purchase plans, their personal lease plans. I'm not going to try and explain it all now. Your dealer can probably do a better job, but they basically make buying cars more affordable because you defer part of the payment. So, you know, yes, you're still going to be paying for the depreciation on a car like that, but those sort of lease deals do make it slightly more acceptable.
The two things I learned from my grandmother about cars. The first one was never buy a red car. I don't know what that's got to do with anything. Never buy a red car. And the second one was never buy a new car. Because as soon as you drive off the forecourt, you've lost a few grand, haven't you?
The thing you've got to do is make sure you do the right deal. The dealers are always happy to haggle. In fact, some of them don't like it if you don't. They find you a bit odd if you don't try and haggle. And do your research beforehand. There's plenty of information out there on the internet to help you haggle and get a good deal. And the finance deals as well are really good at the moment.
The last time I bought a car, and I walked in, and I used to be on TV a little bit, and the woman recognised me. She said, oh, you're on the telly. I said, yeah, I was on the telly about 5 years ago. I'm not earning telly money now. And they wouldn't believe it. They thought I was a multimillionaire and was, you know, lighting cigars with £50 notes. And I went in there to do a bit of haggling, and they just said, No, you can afford it.
You can
afford to pay the price. Unbelievable.
I have a similar problem. If I'm driving a nice car, which I do occasionally, it's on the driveway, you have somebody come round to quote for painting your house or something, stick the price up because they think you can afford it. It's not my car.
We've got some callers. We've got Matt from Stenning. Matt, where's Stenning?
Oh, hi. It's about 15 miles from Brighton in Sussex.
Oh, okay.
West Sussex.
You got a question for Steve. Go on, what is it?
Yes, yeah, well, it's fuel economy related, actually. I was just thinking of replacing my 12-year-old Ford Focus. I've got about 8,000, so I can't frustratingly get into that sort of super frugal bracket of the cars coming out now. So I wondered, can you, for about 8,000, get something really economical, or is it worth spending a little bit more and going for a more modern generation, really frugal car?
Well, there's two things I would say. Yes, you can get something that's really economical. Depends how many miles you're doing. And this is where whenever you buy a car, you've got to do your sums. Diesel is obviously the thing to go for if you want an economical car. But you pay more for diesel cars. You pay more for diesel fuel. So you have to work out, how many miles do I do a year? Will I break even compared to an equivalent petrol car? And there are some decent petrol cars out there. So yes, look around. If economy is your sole driver, then buy a good diesel. There are plenty out there of that sort of money. You'll get a fairly decent one. Things like Vauxhalls, for example, they drop in value quite a lot. So a used Astra or even an Insignia diesel will be pretty good at that sort of money. But also, as I was saying earlier, think about finance packages, because you might, with a decent deposit and with a monthly payment, be able to get into one of those super economical cars you were talking about.
That's Matt, great, thank you.
Thank you very much for that. One of the I'm so old. One of the things when I was looking for buying a car last year, cars don't have tape players in anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And it blew my mind, because I've got a load of tapes.
What do you do?
Where am I going to play my tapes? And I said it again in this dealership, and they just laughed at me, as pretty much everyone behind the glass looking at me now is doing. They said, tapes?
What's a tape?
What's a tape? We got another caller. We've got John on the line. John, what's your question?
Yeah. Hi, Steve.
Hi, John.
I've got a 9-year-old Mercedes Vanio. I guess, for want of a better description, it's somewhere between an MPV and a Popemobile. the problem is that the electronics are slowly giving up on it. There's sort of a persistent unidentified battery drain, which necessitates me having to use a key fob to switch the battery off electronically. The interior lights are permanently on, and if I want to sort of centrally lock the car, I have to do twice in order to do that. So it's probably one of those things, if you start looking underneath, it's going to be an expensive bill. So what's the best way for me to sort of move on and sell the car?
Well, there's any number of ways of saying. Can I mention my favourite fact about the Mercedes Vanio as well? Because you know most cars have trim levels like GL or Gear or things like that. The Vanio actually had a trim level called Dog, which was fantastic. A very brave thing for any car company to do. I don't know if yours is a Vanio Dog, but the way to get rid of it, frankly, is put it in the classifieds. There are no end of classifieds out there that have lots of good response, or a part exchange. But of course, the most important thing is to work out how much it's worth, so that you're not going to sell yourself short. Get online. Lots of free valuation systems.
Steve, is he going to lose a lot of money because, well, it doesn't work properly? He'll have to announce that, won't he? He can't keep quiet.
Yes, I would always say you do have to announce it because it's the honest thing to do. Now, the other thing to do, of course, is there may be other people suffering from the same problem. And the great thing about car owners is they like to chat. They like to go online. They like to blog about these things. And I wouldn't be surprised if you were to type in a few keywords about the Vanio and the problems you're having, you might find a fairly simple fault, or there might be a specialist or a Mercedes specialist rather than the main dealer who might be cheaper to actually fix the problem, and it might help you fall in love with your car again.
John, have you not taken it to the garage to let them have a look at it?
It does tend to be quite expensive visits to the official garage. There is a very good electronic specialist down the road, and I've had some quotes. It's just, for a 9-year-old car, it's kind of a bit of a catch-22, whether you get the work done or whether you just move it on.
It sounds like you can live with a car, so be honest, stick it in the classifieds and move on.
All right, excellent stuff. Thank you very much. We've got another text. I don't know who this is from. It's anonymous. Ooh. My wife is looking to change her 2012 1.7 CDTI Astra in the next 6 months. There's a new Corsa this year. Is there going to be a new Astra next year or so? And therefore, should she wait or cash in and get the existing model at vastly discounted prices in the next 6 months?
Well, there are some great deals out there on the Astra. I've seen thousands off that car, which does indicate a new model is on the way, as does the spy shots that we've seen of the cars, where they have all these swirly paint jobs on them so we don't recognise them. But we know a new Astra is out there in testing. We're expecting to see it next year, probably be launched at the Geneva Motor Show next March at a guess, and on sale towards the middle or the end of next year. I'm told it's going to look really good, like the Monza concept that we saw last year from Vauxhall. So it's on the way, not within the next 6 months. The deals on Astras are incredible at the moment and will only get better. New Corsa will be out probably by the end of the year. We'll see it sometime in the summer.
Okay, we've got another call. We've got Susan in Lytham St. Anne's. Oh, a Ford Fiesta, my first ever car. Go on, Susan.
Hi, Steve.
Hello, Susan.
Well, I have actually bought a Ford Fiesta in March. And my question is, I bought the 1,000cc EcoBoost engine. And I just wondered, Is this particular engine worth the extra £650 I paid?
It is a brilliant engine. It's a really clever piece of engineering. It's a three-cylinder engine. If it's an extra £650, it sounds as though you haven't got the turbocharged one, you've got the standard one, but it is a really, really good engine. I mean, the Fiesta is a brilliant car, apart from the fact at the moment it has an advert with the worst dubbing on it since the Kinder Ed adverts from years ago. The Fiesta is one of those cars, we're always looking for a car that kind of makes you feel a bit special, makes it feel as though it's from a class above, and from that point of view, it is really good. It feels really posh. And that little engine it makes you feel as though you're going a little bit faster than you might be. If you like your driving, it's got a little buzz about it. It's really punchy. You've done exactly the right thing. Yes, it was a little bit more expensive. It'll be more efficient and a lot more fun to drive.
Susan, excellent stuff. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
You're very, very welcome. Steve, let's get on to your motoring news. Now, not enough people, as we know, are buying electric cars for the government's liking. But what if owners could drive in bus lanes and park for free? Well, councils are set to be given millions in extra funding if they allow special privileges to drivers of electric vehicles. There's half a billion quid in the pot, isn't there?
There is, yes. Some of that is going to try and tempt us to actually buy the cars. We've had these £5,000 incentives for low emissions vehicles for quite a while, and that's going to be extended. But of that £500 million that's been put up for grabs, there is an amount of money that's going to go to ultra low cities. £35 million is up for grabs, and as you say, it will enable people to park for free and drive down the bus lanes if they've got a low emissions vehicle.
Nick Clegg said it was a no-brainer to own an electric car, but A, they cost a lot of money, and B, there's not that many charging stations. Are there enough?
There's not enough at the moment. And again, a lot of the money, I think it's £32 million, is going to go into the infrastructure. And it can't happen soon enough, because that, of course, is the big problem, the big worry for people. Range anxiety is a phrase that's been created for electric cars. And you've got to have somewhere to charge them.
Range anxiety, for those who don't know, and I learnt this because I'm dead clever, me. It's the fear that you'll be left stranded if the car's battery runs flat. It has been a problem. Yep. And supporters have been arguing that programmes like Top Gear haven't helped after showing electric cars, such as the Tesla Roadster, grinding to a halt. In fact, have a listen to this. It was a review of that car in 2008 which ended up in the courts.
This car then really was shaping up to be something wonderful. But then, although Tesla say it'll do 200 miles, we worked out that on our track it would run out after just 55 miles. And if it does run out, it's not a quick job to charge it up again.
Well, there's Clarkson there upsetting people. What a surprise. Tesla weren't happy with that. They claimed the scene had been faked. They took the BBC to court for libel, but the case was thrown out last year. Speaking to Newsnight a short time after, Tesla's founder, entrepreneur and billionaire Elon Musk, the man who's also behind PayPal, interestingly enough, was asked what he thought of Jeremy Clarkson.
Clarkson's show is much more about entertainment than it is about truth. And I think most people realize that, but not everyone. He can be very funny and irreverent, but he does have a strong bias against electric cars, and he particularly seems to hate American. Like, his two pet peeves are Americans, American cars, and electric cars. And we're an American electric car, so we're we're in the worst possible situation for someone like Clarkson.
Well, I think Clarkson's in the worst possible situation for someone like Clarkson. Tesla are just about to launch their second model in the UK. It's called the Tesla Model S, a car already owned by some pretty big names, including Cameron Diaz, will.i.am, Shakira, and the man who's reworked, if you're happy and you know it, clap your hands, Pharrell. Steve, you've been driving one as well, haven't you?
Good enough for Pharrell's good enough for me, yeah. I've been driving the Model S, which is going on sale in the UK from around £50,000 soon, and it's one of the best cars I've driven this year. It's incredible, and the biggest thing is the range, because somehow the range is far longer than you would expect. Yes, if you're going to drive it around a test track like the Top Gear test track, the range will be reduced, but they claim a range of minimum 240 miles. We know all that those claims are official claims and you won't get it, but I did over 200 miles in an electric car between charges, which I didn't think was possible, and on top of that, it's a pretty good car too.
Steve, stay there. We'll come back to you in a second. Now we can speak to the boss of Tesla Europe, Georg L. Hi, Georg. Why do you think people have failed to fall in love with electric cars?
Will do.
It's an interesting question, isn't it? I think attitudes are changing, actually. I think we're seeing more and more range extended and plug-in hybrid cars. We're seeing performance cars now start to include electric motors in them as well. And I think it's entering the consciousness of the British public that electric motors have got an awful lot to offer. And, of course, the best thing to do is to get behind the wheel of one and drive it, which we're just starting to do in the UK now out of Westfield in London. And as Steve was saying, it starts to address a lot of the common concerns that people have, particularly with range. Our rated range is actually 312 miles. The nice little story is I think the world record anyone's ever driven in one of ours is over 500 miles, although I will say I think they drove the whole thing at 18 miles an hour and were stopped at one point for dangerous driving. So
well, there you go.
It does depend a bit on how you use your foot.
They're not cheap, are they, Georg? Around £50,000, 50,000 pounds. Is Tesla always going to be a premium brand, or do you think there will be cheaper models?
Well, Tesla's a company born out of Silicon Valley in California. Elon Musk, who, as you said, is also behind PayPal and SpaceX, a company that intends to put people on Mars. You know, he dreams extremely big. So our mission is to accelerate the world's transition to sustainable transport. And it's about much more than just building premium vehicles. But it's certainly true to say the Model S is a premium luxury saloon and competes with other premium luxury combustion engine cars. And actually, in our mature markets, we outsell the other manufacturers that you might think of. So today, doing very well in that segment, but I think in the future we hope to produce electric vehicles for millions of people.
Georg, Tesla's been in a bit of bother in the States with some of the car dealers, because you don't sell your cars through dealers, and some of the dealers that are pretty powerful in the States have stopped you from selling cars in some territories. Is that a big problem? Is that going to be a problem over here?
I don't foresee it being a big problem over here. And you know, I think there's legal battles going on in the US. It hasn't harmed public perception. I think one of the reasons that the dealership unions in the US are so upset is, of course, that they make an awful lot of money on servicing in other aspects. And Elon has talked publicly about how servicing ought not to be a profit center for us. You know, why should a manufacturer make a bulk of its profits when the product essentially goes wrong?
So, Georg, I'm sorry to interrupt. We have to end it there because we're running out of time. That's Georg Ell from Tesla Europe. Steve, we haven't got much time left, I'm afraid. So let's do your cars of the week, if you don't mind. As always, a pricey one, a mid-range, and more budget.
Well, it seems right that the pricey one this week should be the BMW i8. It's a plug-in hybrid car. It's a supercar, just under £100,000. Brilliantly quick, brilliant to drive, and I reckon the future of supercars.
Have you driven one?
I haven't. One of my colleagues was lucky enough to drive it, and he said it's absolutely sensational.
I get nervous when I drive someone else's car. When you're driving a car that costs £100,000, are you not sat there going, oh my days, let me crash it.
There is part of me. I was in quite an expensive car today in a car park, and I'm watching those curbs very, very carefully.
I'm constantly scraping my car. I'd be terrified. A mid-range one, please.
Mid-range,
Steve.
I mentioned it earlier, the Audi A6 Ultra, the best A6 in the range, really economical, really well-built, good to drive too.
And a cheap one.
New Volkswagen Polo.
Oh,
it's
wow.
The poshest small car, always has been, and now it's got the three-cylinder engine, similar to that in the Fiesta we were talking about earlier, and a whole lot more kit as well, so it's more advanced.
Steve, I'm sorry we had to cut it short. Thank you so much for your time. It's nice to talk to you. I'm a little bit disappointed he's called the VW Polo a cheap car. As I climb into mine this evening, I'll be wiping a tear away. It's Steve Fowler. Excellent stuff. Thank you. That's it. That's your lot from me. I've been Ian Lee. Chris will be back next week. Thank you very, very much. Stephen Nolan is up next.